We'll be right back. Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Well, hey everybody, happy weekend. Give me a second here. Okay, happy weekend, everybody. I hope you had a great weekend. My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour or so. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team, and that means if you think you have a paranormal problem, find us. Just Google us, California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team, on Google, and you'll find us. Anyway, I'm glad to be here. We have a lucky new era going on here because I finally figured out how to make TikTok not fall. when I've tried to do this read, inadvertently TikTok, what I had it hooked up to would fall. And this Sunday, I finally figured it out. Late last night, I was futzing around, and I finally figured out how to not make TikTok fall over, or how to keep TikTok from falling over. So I'm real excited about that. Anyway, of course, this is Sunday, and this is the day we read. We read from our paranormal-themed book, and the one we're working on right now is it's not Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, it's Frankenstein, but it has, this long title on it. I didn't expect that long a title on that book, because you always hear it, like for the movie, you hear it, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So every Sunday, I try to read from a paranormal-themed book, whether it's real paranormal stories or fantasy stories or whatever. And the last book we finished was Count Dracula. This week, again, I'm going to be reading from I'm going to call it Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So we're going to be reading from Frankenstein. We're in chapter 4. We continue. Then I'll get you guys a quick update before we start reading. News coming in right now. Thank you. I see a bunch of you have joined on TikTok. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Please do me a favor over on TikTok and double tap that screen. If you enjoy me reading the book on Sunday, please feel free to double tap that screen. Looking for like 1,000 likes, right? And I do have a goal for some llamas. You don't have to do that, but that would be nice as well. But this is California Haunts Radio. I broadcast Sunday through Friday every week. I'm going to start doing a Saturday night show as well. And because I figured out how to mount TikTok without it falling over on me, you guys will be privy to my show tomorrow, so you can watch my live show tomorrow, which I'll be doing at 6:30 p.m. Pacific. Okay, that being said, over here, Facebook, where am I? TikTok over here. Facebook, Facebook, YouTube, Twitch. Be sure to hit that like button if you like what you see in here tonight. I really appreciate it. That puts us up in the FYP and gets more attention towards us, right? I'd really appreciate that. And as you can see, our Patreon address is down there. Go on over to our Patreon and check that out as well. Okay, so we left off. We were in starting chapter 4 of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And it's not what the book's called, you guys. Just a quick reminder. It's not what the book's called at all. But it's easier to say than the whole thing. It's just this big, long title that I can't even remember what it is. So we're just going to go with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. We left off when Henry, being eventually Dr. Frankenstein, right? Henry is now on his way to college, and growing up, he had an interest in science, but not the normal science that everybody has an interest in, right? This was in the first three chapters, and we learn that he had this bizarre interest in helping the dead. Helping the dead rise, right? I mean, that's what Frankenstein's all about. He creates the monster. Well, not really. He creates a dead, he gets a dead person, raises it from the dead, and then it turns on everybody, and it's nasty, and it's ugly, and all that. So we're at the point now where he's now an adult, he's going to college, and he's now starting to take courses that will help him in his goals of building and creating this monster. So what I'm going to be doing is, I have an ebook here. This is all free. This is if you guys that are interested and you like to read. This is for Project Gutenberg. And these people have taken these books starting from like the 1700s all the way until like 1945, and they've transcribed them into ebooks, and they are out of copyright. So that means you can't get in trouble for reading them like I'm doing it online. So you can't get in trouble for reading them online. So that's what I'm reading from as a Project Gutenberg book. But you can go over to projectgutenberg.com, and they have thousands of books over there you can look up. So if you're into reading, that's the way to go. That's how I discovered them. In fact, we've been reading Project Gutenberg books on here for about half a year now. So I'm real excited to bring that to you. So sit back, you know, grab some popcorn, grab some hot cocoa, or whatever it is you do, like on your Sunday night. Some of you, it's Monday already over on TikTok. But great, you know, and put your fuzzy slippers on, and I'm going to read from what I call Mary Shelley's Frankenstein for about an hour. We'll try and get through two or three chapters and then call it a day. I can actually almost see your messages over there. It's getting really close. I'm going to put like a magnifier up here next week so I can actually read your messages. I have old eyes, you guys. So just to let you know, and just to make sure, you know, I want to make sure my audio is working. Let me reach on over there. Let me turn that up. Okay. Normally I would be on my headset tomorrow, you know, but since I'm doing my show, I'm on this headset for the main laptop. Okay, here we go. I'm going to read from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and I hope you enjoy it. And I'll be reading for about an hour. So if you're into books, like I said, just put your feet up and sit back and enjoy the ride. Okay? Double tap the screen too if you like the book. All right? It's a lot different than what we saw in the movies, because you know there's been several versions of this movie, and yeah, you know, Boris Karloff version. You got the real Mary Shelley's Frankenstein movie. You know, you've even got a version with Lon Chaney as the monster. Even I know that. Okay? So just enjoy, sit back, enjoy, and I'm going to be reading for about an hour. So it's 6:10 now. We're going to go to 7:10 p.m. Pacific. All right, here we go. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and we continue. From this day, natural philosophy, and particularly chemistry, let me get this to the mic so I can hear myself. Okay, from this day, natural philosophy, and particularly chemistry, in the most comprehensive sense of the term, became nearly my sole occupation. This is Henry talking. So this is like his diary. I read with ardor those works, so full of genius and discrimination, which modern inquiries, I'm going to come up a little bit, have written on these subjects. I attended the lectures and cultivated the acquaintance of the men of science of the university, and I found even in M. Crimpy a great deal of sound sense and real information, combined, it is true, with a repulsive physiognomy, there's some words that throw me, physiognomy, and manners, but not on that account the less valuable. In M. Waldman, I found a true friend. His gentleness was never tinged by dogmatism, and his instructions were never given with an air of frankness, frankness, and good nature that banished every idea of pedantry. In a thousand ways, he smoothed for me the path of knowledge and made the most abstruse inquiries clear and facile to my apprehension. My application was at first fluctuating and uncertain. It gained strength as I proceeded, and soon became so ardent and eager that the stars often disappeared in the light of morning, whilst I was yet engaged in my laboratory. As I applied so closely, it may be easily conceived that my progress was rapid. My ardor was indeed astonishment of the student. What was indeed? Did I say astonishment? Yeah, it was indeed the astonishment of the students. And my proficiency, that of the masters. Professor Crimp often asked me with a sly smile how Cornelius Agrippa went on, whilst M. Waldman expressed the most heartfelt exultation in my progress. 2 years passed in this manner, during which I paid no visit to Geneva, but was so engaged, heart and soul, in the pursuit of some discoveries which I hoped to make. None but those who have experienced them can conceive of the enticements of science. In other studies, you go as far as others have gone before you, and there is nothing more to know. But in a scientific pursuit, there is a continual food for discovery and wonder. A mind of moderate capacity, which closely pursues one study, must infallibly arrive at great proficiency in that study. And I, who continually sought the attainment of one object of pursuit, and was solely wrapped up in this, improved so rapidly that at the end of 2 years, I made some discoveries in the improvement of some chemical instruments, which procured me great esteem and admiration at the university. When I had arrived at this point and had become as well acquainted with the theory and practice of natural philosophy as depended on the lessons of any of the professors at Ingolstadt, my residence there became no longer conducive to my improvements. I thought of returning to my friends and my native town, when an incident happened that protracted my stay. One of the phenomena which had peculiarly attracted my attention was the structure of the human frame, and, indeed, any animal endued with life. Whence, I often asked myself, did the principle of life proceed? It was a bold question, and one which has ever been considered as a mystery. Yet, with how many things are we upon the brink of becoming acquainted, if cowardice or carelessness do not restrain our inquiries? I revolved these circumstances in my mind, and determined thenceforth to apply myself more particularly to those branches of natural philosophy which relate to physiology. Unless I had been animated by an almost supernatural enthusiasm, my application to this study would have been irksome and almost intolerable. To examine the causes of life, we must first have recourse to death. I became acquainted with the science of anatomy, but this was not sufficient. I must also observe the natural decay and corruption of the human body. In my education, my father had taken the greatest precautions that my mind should be impressed with no supernatural horrors. I do not ever remember to have trembled at a tale of superstition, or to have feared the apparition of a spirit. Darkness had no effect upon my fancy, and a churchyard was to me merely the receptacle of bodies deprived of life, which, from being the seat of beauty and strength, had become food for the worm. Now I was led to examine the cause and progress of this decay, and forced to spend days and nights in vaults and charnel houses. My attention was fixed upon every object, the most insupportable to the delicacy of the human feelings. I saw how the fine form of a man was degraded and wasted. I beheld the corruption of death succeed to the blooming cheek of life. I saw how the worm inherited the wonders of the eye and brain. I paused, examining and analyzing all the minutiae of causation, as exemplified in the change from life to death, and death to life, until from the midst of this darkness a sudden light broke in upon me, a light so brilliant and wondrous, yet so simple, that while I became dizzy with the immensity of the prospect which it illustrated, I was surprised that among so many men of genius who had directed their inquiries towards the same science, that I alone should be reserved to discover so astonishing a secret. Remember, I am not recording the vision of a madman. The sun does not more certainly shine in the heavens than that which I now affirm is true. Some miracle might have produced it, yet the stages of the discovery were distinct and probable. After days and nights of incredible labor and fatigue, I succeeded in discovering the cause of generation and life. Nay, more. I became myself capable of bestowing animation upon lifeless matter. The astonishment which I had first experienced on this discovery soon gave place to delight and rapture. After so much time spent in painful labor, to arrive at once at the summit of my desires was the most gratifying consummation of my toils. But this discovery was so great and overwhelming that all the steps by which I had been progressively led to it were obliterated, and I beheld only the result, what had been the study and desire of the wisest men, since the creation of the world was now within my grasp. Not that, like a magic scene, it all opened up at once. The information I had obtained was of a nature rather to direct my endeavors so soon as I should point them towards the object of my search than to exhibit that object already accomplished. I was like the Arabian who had been buried with the dead and found a passage to life, aided only by one glimmering and seemingly ineffectual light. I see by your eagerness and the wonder and hope which your eyes express, my friend, that you expect to be informed of the secret with which I am acquainted. That cannot be. Listen patiently until the end of my story, and you will easily perceive why I am reserved upon that subject. I will not lead you on unguarded and ardent, as I then was, to your destruction and infallible misery. Learn from me, if not by my precepts, at least by my example, how dangerous is the acquirement of knowledge, and how much happier that man is who believes his native town to be the world than he who aspires to become greater than his nature will allow. When I found so astonishing a power placed within my hands. I hesitated a long time concerning the manner in which I should employ it. Although I possessed the capacity of bestowing animation, yet to prepare a frame for the reception of it, with all of its intricacies and fibers, muscles, and veins, still remained a work of inconceivable difficulty and labor. I doubted at first whether I should attempt the creation of a being like myself, or one of similar organization. But my imagination was too much exalted by my first success to permit me to doubt of my ability to give life to an animal as complex and wonderful as a man. The materials at present within my command hardly appeared adequate to do so arduous an undertaking, but I doubted not that I should ultimately succeed. I prepared myself for a multitude of reverses. My operations might be incessantly baffled, and at last my work be imperfect. Yet, when I consider the improvement which every day takes place in science and mechanics, I was encouraged to hope my present attempts would at least lay the foundations of future success. Nor could I consider the magnitude and complexity of my plan as any argument of its impracticability. It was with these feelings that I began the creation of a human being. As the minuteness of the parts formed a great hindrance to my speed, I resolved, contrary to my first intention, to make the being of a gigantic stature. That is to say, about 8 feet in height, and proportionately large. After having formed this determination and having spent some months in successfully collecting and arranging my materials, I began. No one can conceive the variety of feelings which bore me onwards, like a hurricane. In the first, enthusiasm of success. Life and death appear to me ideal bounds, which I should first break through and pour a torrent of light into our dark world. A new species would bless me as its creator and source. Many happy and excellent natures would owe their being to me. No father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as I should deserve theirs. Pursuing these reflections, I thought that if I could bestow animation upon a lifeless matter, I might, in process of time, although I now found it impossible, renew life where death had apparently devoted the body to corruption. Those thoughts supported my spirits while I pursued my undertaking with unremitting ardor. My cheek had grown pale with study, and my person had become emaciated with confinement. Sometimes, on the very brink of certainty, I failed, yet still I clung to the hope which the next day or the next hour might realize. One secret, which I alone possessed, was the hope to which I had dedicated myself, and the moon gazed on my midnight labors. While with unrelaxed and breathless eagerness, I pursued nature to her hiding places. Who shall conceive the horrors of my secret toil as I dabbled among the unhallowed depths of the grave or tortured the living animal to animate the lifeless clay? My limbs now tremble, and my eyes swim with the remembrance. But then a resistless and almost frantic impulse urged me forward. I seemed to have lost all soul or sensation but for this one pursuit. It was indeed but a passing trance that only made me feel with renewed acuteness, so soon as the unnatural stimulus ceasing to operate. I had returned to my old habits. I collected bones from charnel houses, and disturbed with profane fingers the tremendous secrets of the human frame. In a solitary chamber, or rather cell, at the top of the house, and separated from all the other apartments by a gallery and staircase, I kept my workshop a filthy creation. My eyeballs were starting from their sockets and attending the details of my employment. The dissecting room and the slaughterhouse furnished many of my materials, and often did my human nature turn with loathing for my occupation, whilst still urged on by an eagerness which perpetually increased. I brought my work near to a conclusion. Real quick, everybody, I'm reading from Frankenstein, okay? And this book was written in the 1800s. Do not turn me into the internet police. I'm reading from the book. This is from a book, okay? This isn't true. You know, and there's stuff that is in here that may not be, you know, I don't want to say the word woke, but may not be, you know, things that people want to, you know, like hearing now. I'm trying to clean it up as I go, all right? But this is a book. It's based on, this is what the movie Frankenstein was based on. So, no internet police. The summer months passed while I was thus engaged, heart and soul in one pursuit. It was a most beautiful season. Never did the fields bestow a more plentiful harvest, or the vines yield a more luxuriant vintage. But my eyes were insensible to the charms of nature, and the same feelings which made me neglect the scenes around me caused me also to forget those friends who were so many miles absent, and whom I had not seen for so long a time. I knew my silence disquieted them, and I well remembered the words of my father. I know that while you're pleased with yourself, you will think of us with affection, and we shall hear regularly from you. You must pardon me if I regard any interruption in your correspondence as a proof that your other duties are equally neglected. I knew well, therefore, what would be my father's feelings, but I could not tear my thoughts from my employment, loathsome in itself, but which had taken an irresistible hold of my imagination. I wished, as it were, to procrastinate all that related to my feelings and affection until the great object, which swallowed up my every habit of my nature, should be completed. I then thought that my father would be unjust if he ascribed my neglect to vice or faultiness on my part. But I am now convinced that he was justified in conceiving that I should not be altogether free from blame. A human being, in perfection, ought always to preserve a calm and peaceful mind, and never allow passion or a transitory desire to disturb his tranquility. I do not think that the pursuit of knowledge is an exception to this rule. If the study to which you apply yourself has a tendency to weaken your affections, and to destroy your taste for those simple pleasures in which no alloy can possibly mix, then that study is certainly unlawful. That is to say, not befitting the human mind. If this rule were always observed, if no man allowed any pursuit whatsoever to interfere with the tranquility of his domestic affections, Greece had not been enslaved. Caesar would have spared his country. America would have been discovered more gradually, and the empires of Mexico and Peru had not been destroyed. But I forgot that I am moralizing, and the most interesting part of my tale, and your looks remind me to proceed. My father made no reproach in his letters, and only took notice of my silence by inquiring into my occupations more particularly than before. Winter, spring, and summer passed away during my labors, but I did not watch the blossom or the expanding leaves sights, which before always yielded me supreme delight. So deeply was I engrossed in my occupation. The leaves of that year had withered before my work drew near to a close, and now every day showed me more plainly how well I had succeeded. But my enthusiasm was checked by my anxiety, and I appeared rather like one doomed by slavery to toil in the mines or any other unwholesome trade that an artist occupied by his favorite employment. Every night I was oppressed by a slow fever, and I became nervous to a most painful degree. The fall of a leaf startled me, and I shunned my fellow creatures as if I had been guilty of a crime. Sometimes I grew alarmed at the wreck I perceived that I had become. The energy of my purpose alone sustained me. My labors would soon end, and I believed that exercise and amusement would then drive away insipid disease. And I promised myself both of these when my creation should be complete. We're going to chapter 5. Again, for everybody that's coming in and the people that are lurking, I know you're out there. I'm reading from Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and this is something we do every Sunday. Chapter 5. Quick drink. Water, guys. Okay, continuing on. Creepy book, Halloween time. Let's read. It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils. With an anxiety that almost accounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me, that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 a.m. The rain pattered dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out, when, by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard, and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. How could I describe my emotions at this catastrophe, or how delineate the wretch whom, with such infinite pains and care, I had endeavored to form? His limbs were in proportion, and I had selected his features as beautiful, beautiful. Great God, his yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth of a pearly whiteness. But these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun-white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. The different accidents of life are not so changeable as the feelings of human nature. I had worked hard for nearly 2 years for the sole purpose of infusing life into an inanimate body. For this, I had deprived myself of rest and health. I had desired it with an ardor that far exceeded moderation, but now that I had finished, the beauty of the dream vanished, and breathless horror and disgust filled my heart. Unable to endure the aspect of the being I had created, I rushed out of the room and continued a long time traversing my bedchamber, unable to compose my mind to sleep. At length, lassitude succeeded to the tumult I had before to the tumult I had before endured, and I threw myself on the bed in my clothes, endeavoring to seek a few moments of forgetfulness. But it was in vain. I slept, indeed, but I was disturbed by the wildest dreams. I thought I saw Elizabeth in the bloom of health walking in the streets of Ingolstadt. Delighted and surprised, I embraced her, but as I imprinted the first kiss on her lips, they became livid with the hue of death. Her features appeared to change, and I thought that I held the corpse of my dead mother in my arms. A shroud enveloped her form, and I saw the grave worms crawling in the folds of the flannel. I started from my sleep with horror. A cold dew covered my forehead. My teeth chattered, and every limb became convulsed. When, by the dim and yellow light of the moon, as it forced its way through the window shutters, I beheld the wretch, the miserable monster whom I had created. He held up the curtain of the bed, and his eyes, if eyes they may be called, were fixed on me. His jaws opened, and he muttered some inarticulate sounds, while a grin wrinkled his cheeks. He might have spoken, but I did not hear. One hand was stretched out, seemingly to detain me, but I escaped and rushed downstairs. I took refuge in the courtyard belonging to the house which I inhabited, where I remained during the rest of the night, walking up and down in the greatest agitation, listening attentively, catching and fearing each sound as if it were to announce the approach of the corpse to which I had so miserably given life. Oh, no moral could support the horror of that countenance. A mummy again endued with animation could not be so hideous as that wretch. I had gazed on him while unfinished. He was ugly then, but when those muscles and joints were rendered capable of motion, it became a thing such as even Dante could not have conceived. I passed the night wretchedly. Sometimes my pulse beat so quickly and hardly that I felt the palpitation of every artery. At others, I nearly sank to the ground through languor and extreme weakness. Mingled with his horror, or with this horror, I felt the bitterness of disappointment. Dreams that had been my food and pleasant rest for so long a space were now becoming a hell to me, and the change was so rapid, the overthrow so complete. Morning, dismal and wet, at length dawned and discovered to my sleepless and aching eyes the church of Ingolstadt, its white steeple and clock, which indicated the sixth hour. The porter opened the gates of the court, which had that night been my asylum, and I issued into the streets, pacing them with quick steps, as if I sought to avoid the wretch whom I feared every turning of the street would present to my view. I did not dare return to the apartment which I inhabited, but felt impelled to hurry on, although drenched by the rain which poured from a black and comfortless sky. I continued walking in this manner for some time, endeavoring by bodily exertion to ease the load that weighed upon my mind. I traversed the streets without any clear conception of where I was or what I was doing. My heart palpitated in the sickness of fear, and I hurried on with irregular steps, not daring to look about me. Like one who on a lonely road doth walk in fear and dread, and having once turned round, walks on, and turns no more his head, because he knows a frightful fiend doth close behind him tread. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. Continuing thus, I rubbed it. Scared me. You know, he's horrible. I was rubbing this on the mic. Scared me. Did I tell you something? Continuing, says, I came at length opposite to the inn in which the various diligences and carriages usually stopped. Here I paused. I knew not why, but I remained some minutes with my eyes fixed on a coach that was coming towards me from the other end of the street. As it drew nearer, I observed that it was the Swiss diligence. It stopped just where I was standing, and on the door being opened, I perceived Henry Clerval, who, on seeing me, instantly sprung out. My dear Frankenstein, exclaimed he, how glad I am to see you. How fortunate that you should be here at the very moment of my alighting. Nothing could equal my delight on seeing Clerval. His presence brought back to my thoughts my father, Elizabeth, and all those scenes of home so dear to my recollection. I grasped his hand, and in a moment forgot my horror and misfortune. I felt suddenly, and for the first time during many months, calm and serene joy. I welcomed my friend, therefore, in the most cordial manner, and we walked towards my college. Clerval continued walking or talking for some time about our mutual friends and his own good fortune in being permitted to come to Ingolstadt. You may easily believe, he said, how great was the difficulty to persuade my father that all necessary knowledge was not comprised in the noble art of bookkeeping, and, indeed, I believe I left him incredulous at last, for his constant answer to my unwary entreaties was the same as that of the Dutch schoolmaster and the Vicar of Wakefield. I have 10,000 florins a year without Greek. I eat heartily without Greek. But his affection for me at length overcame his dislike of learning, and he has permitted me to undertake a voyage of discovery to the land of knowledge. It gives me the greatest delight to see you. But tell me how you left my father, brothers, and Elizabeth. Very well and very happy, only a little uneasy that they hear from you so seldom. By the by, I mean to lecture you a little upon their account myself. But my dear Frankenstein, continued he, stopping short and gazing full in my face, I did not before remark how very ill you appear, so thin and pale. You look as if you have been watching for several nights. You have guessed right. I have lately been so deeply engaged in one occupation that I have not allowed myself sufficient rest, as you see. But I hope, I sincerely hope, that all these employments are now at an end, and that I am at length free. I trembled excessively. I could not endure to think of, and far less to allude to, the occurrences of the preceding night. I walked with a quick pace, and we soon arrived at my college. I then reflected, and the thought made me shiver, that the creature whom I had left in my apartment might still be there, alive and walking about. I dreaded to behold this monster, but I feared still more that Henry should see him. Entreating him, therefore, to remain a few minutes at the bottom of the stairs, I darted up towards my own room. My hand was already on the lock of the door before I recollected myself. I then paused, and cold shivering came over me. I threw the door forcibly open. Oh, no creak today. Okay, see, hang on a second. I'm walking. Okay, jump the page. I drew the door forcibly open, as children are accustomed to do when they expect. You know what? When I was doing Dracula, remember? I could get this thing to really creak. There we go. All right, you ready? I threw the door forcibly open. There we go. As children are accustomed to do when they expect the specters to stand and waiting for them on the other side. But nothing appeared. I stepped fearfully in. The apartment was empty, and my bedroom was also freed from its hideous guest. I could hardly believe that so great a good fortune could have befallen me. But when I became assured that my enemy had indeed fled, I clapped my hands for joy and ran down to Clerval. Okay. We ascended into my room, and the servant presently brought breakfast. But I was unable to contain myself. It was not joy only that possessed me. I felt my flesh tingle with excess of sensitiveness, and my pulse beat rapidly. I was unable to remain for a single instant in the same place. I jumped over the chairs, clapped my hands, and laughed aloud. Clerval at first attributed my unusual spirits to joy on his arrival, but when he observed me more attentively, he saw wildness in my eyes for which he could not account, and my loud, unrestrained, heartless laughter frightened and astonished him. My dear Victor, he cried, what for God's sake is the matter? Do not laugh in that matter. How ill you are! What is the cause of all this? Do not ask me, cried I, putting my hands before my eyes, for I thought I saw the dreaded specter glide into the room. He can tell. Oh, save me, save me. I imagined that the monster seized me. I struggled furiously and fell down in a fit. Poor Clerval. What must have been his feelings? A meeting, which he anticipated with such joy, so strangely turned to bitterness. But I was not the witness of his grief, for I was lifeless and did not recover my senses for a long, long time. This was the commencement of a nervous fever, which confined me for several months. During all that time, Henry was my only nurse. I afterwards learned that, knowing my father's advanced age and unfitness for such a long journey, and how wretched my sickness would make Elizabeth, he spared them this grief by concealing the extent of my disorder. He knew that I could not have a more kind and attentive nurse than himself, and firm in the hope he felt of my recovery, he did not doubt that, instead of doing harm, he performed the kindest action that he could towards them. But I was in reality very ill, and surely nothing but the unbounded and unremitting attentions of my friend could have restored me to life. The form of the monster on whom I had bestowed existence was forever before my eyes, and I raved incessantly concerning him. Doubtless my words surprised Henry. He at first believed them to be the wanderings of my disturbed imagination, but the pertinacity with which I continually recurred to the same subject persuaded him that my disorder indeed owed its origins to some uncommon and terrible event. By very slow degrees, and with frequent relapses that alarmed and grieved my friend, I recovered. I remember the first time I became capable of observing outward objects with any kind of pleasure. I perceived that the fallen leaves had disappeared, and that the young buds were shooting forth from the trees that shaded my window. It was a divine spring, and the season contributed greatly to my convalescence. I felt also sentiments of joy and affection revive in my bosom. My gloom had disappeared, and in a short time I became as cheerful as before I was attacked by the fatal passion. "Dearest Clerval," exclaimed I, "how kind, how very good of you are to me. This whole winter, instead of being spent in the study as you promised yourself, has been consumed in my sick room. How shall I ever repay you? I feel the greatest remorse for the disappointment of which I have been the occasion, but you will forgive me? You will repay me entirely if you do not dispose yourself, but get well as fast as you can. And since you appear in such good spirits, I may speak to you on one subject, may I not?" I trembled. One subject? What could it be? Could he allude to an object on whom I dared not even think? "Compose yourself," said Clerval, who observed my change of color. "I will not mention it if it agitates you. But your father and cousin would be very happy if they received a letter from you in your own handwriting. They hardly know how ill you have been, and are uneasy at your long silence." "Is that all, my dear Henry? How could you suppose that my first thought would not fly towards those dear, dear friends whom I love and who are so deserving of my love? If this is your present temper, my friend, you will perhaps be glad to see a letter that has been laying here some days for you. It is from your cousin, I believe." Chapter 6. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, guys. Chapter 6. Clerval then put the following letter into my hands. It was from my own Elizabeth. "My dearest cousin, you've been ill, very ill, and even the constant letters of dear kind Henry are not sufficient to reassure me on your account. You are forbidden to write, to hold a pen, yet one word from you, dear Victor, is necessary to calm our apprehensions. For a long time I have thought that each post would bring this line, and my persuasions have restrained my uncle from undertaking a journey to Ingolstadt. I have prevented his encountering inconveniences and perhaps dangers of so long a journey. Yet, how often have I regretted not being able to perform it myself? I figure to myself that the task of attending on your sickbed has devolved on some mercenary old nurse, who can never guess your wishes nor minister them with the care and affection of your poor cousin. Yet, that is over now. Clerval writes that, indeed, you are getting better. I eagerly hope that you will confirm this intelligence soon in a letter of your own handwriting. Get well and return to us. You will find a happy, cheerful home and friends who love you dearly. Your father's health is vigorous, and he asks but to see you, but to be assured that you are well, and not a care will ever cloud his benevolent countenance. How pleased you would be to remark the improvement of our Ernest. He is now 16 and full of activity and spirit. He is desirous to be a true Swiss and to enter into foreign service. But we cannot part with him, at least until his elder brother returns to us. My uncle is not pleased with the idea of a military career in a distant country, but Ernest never had your powers of application. He looks upon study as an odious fetter. His time is spent in the open air, climbing the hills or rowing on the lake. I fear that he will become an idler unless we yield the point and permit him to enter on the profession which he has selected. Little alteration, except the growth of our dear children, has taken place since you left us. The blue lake and snow-clad mountains, they never change, and I think our placid home and our contented hearts are regulated by the same immutable laws. My trifling occupations take up my time and amusement, and I am rewarded for any exertions by seeing none but happy, kind faces around me. Since you left us, but one change has taken place in our little home. Do you remember on what occasion Justine Moritz entered our family? Probably you do not. I will relate her history, therefore, in a few words. Madame Moritz, her mother, was a widow with four children, with whom Justine was a third. This girl had always been the favorite of her father, but through a strange perversity, her mother could not endure her, and after the death of M. Moritz, treated her very ill. My aunt observed this, and when Justine was 12 years of age, prevailed on her mother to allow her to live in our house. The republican institutions of our country have produced simpler and happier manners than those which prevail in the great monarchies that surround it. Hence, there is less distinction between the several classes of its inhabitants and the lower orders. Being neither so poor nor so despised, their manners are more refined and moral. A servant in Geneva does not mean the same thing as a servant in France or in England. Justine, thus received in our family, learned the duties of a servant, a condition which, in our fortunate country, does not include the idea of ignorance and a sacrifice of the dignity of a human being. Justine, you may remember, was a great favorite of yours, and I recollect you once remarked that if you were in an ill humor, one glance from Justine could dissipate it, for the same reason that Aristo gives concerning the beauty of Angelica. She looked so frank-hearted and happy. My aunt conceived a great attachment for her, by which she was indeed to give her an education superior to that which she had at first intended. This benefit was fully repaid. Justine was the most grateful little creature in the world. I do not mean that she made any professions. I never heard one pass her lips, but you could see by her eyes that she almost adored her protectress. Although her disposition was gay, and in many respects inconsiderate, yet she paid the greatest attention to every gesture of my aunt. She thought her the model of all excellence, and endeavored to imitate her phraseology and manners, so that even now she often reminds me of her. When my dearest aunt died, everyone was too much occupied in her own grief to notice poor Justine, who had attended her during her illness with the most anxious affection. Poor Justine was very ill, but other trials were reserved for her. One by one, her brothers and sister died, and her mother, with the exception of her neglected daughter, was left childless. The conscience of the woman was troubled. She began to think that the deaths of her favorites was a judgment from heaven to chastise her partiality. She was a Roman Catholic, and I believe her confessor confirmed the idea which she had conceived. Accordingly, a few months after your departure for Ingolstadt, Justine was called home by her repentant mother. Poor girl. She wept when she quitted our house. She was much altered since the death of my aunt. Grief had given softness and a winning mildness to her manners, which had before been remarkable. For vivacity, nor was her residence at her mother's house of a nature to restore her gaiety. The poor woman was very vacillating in her repentance. She sometimes begged Justine to forgive her unkindness, but much oftener accused her of having caused the deaths of her brothers and sister. Perpetual fretting at length threw Madame Moritz into a decline, which at first increased her irritability, but she is now at peace forever. She died on the first approach of cold weather at the beginning of this last winter. Justine, has just returned to us, and I assure you I love her tenderly. She is very clever and gentle, and extremely pretty, as I mentioned before. Her mien and her expression continually remind me of my dear aunt. I must say also a few words to you, my dear cousin, of little darling William. I wish you could see him. He is very tall for his age, with sweet, laughing blue eyes, dark eyelashes, and curling hair. When he smiles, two little dimples appear on each cheek, which are rosy with health. He has already had one or two little wives. He's already had one or two little wives, but Louisa Biron is his favorite, a pretty little girl of 5 years of age. Now, dear Victor, I dare say you wish to be indulged in a little gossip concerning the good people of Geneva. The pretty Miss Mansfield has already received congratulatory visits on her approaching marriage with a young Englishman, John Melbourne, Esquire. Her ugly sister, Manon, married M. Duviade, the rich banker, last autumn. Your favorite schoolfellow, Louis Manure, has suffered several misfortunes since the departure of Clerval from Geneva, but he has already recovered his spirits and is reported to be on the point of marrying a lively, pretty Frenchwoman, Madame Tavernier. She is a widow and much older than Manure. Ah, foreign names. But she is very much admired and a favorite with everybody. I have written myself into better spirits, dear cousin, but my anxiety returns upon me as I conclude. Write, dearest Victor, one line, one word would be a blessing to us. 10,000 thanks to Henry for his kindness, his affection, and his many letters. We are sincerely grateful. Adieu, my cousin. Take care of yourself, and I entreat you to write. Elizabeth Lavenza. Geneva, March 18th, 17/what day? Dear, dear Elizabeth, I exclaimed when I had read her letter, I will write instantly and relieve them from the anxiety they must feel. I wrote, and this exertion greatly fatigued me, but my convalescence had commenced and proceeded regularly. In another fortnight, I was able to leave my chamber. One of my first duties on my recovery was to introduce Clerval to the several professors of the university. In doing this, I underwent a kind of rough usage, ill befitting of the wounds that my mind had sustained. Ever since the fatal night, the end of my labors, and the beginning of my misfortunes, I had conceived a violent antipathy even to the name of natural philosophy. When I was otherwise quite restored to health, the sight of a chemical instrument would renew all the agony of my nervous symptoms. Henry saw this and had removed all my apparatus from my view. He had also changed my apartment, for he perceived that I had acquired a dislike for the room which had previously been my laboratory. But these cares of Clerval were made of no avail when I visited the professors, and Waldman inflicted torture when he praised with kindness and warmth the astonishing progress I had made in the sciences. He soon perceived that I disliked the subject, but not guessing the real cause, he attributed my feelings to modesty, and changed the subject from my improvement to the science itself, with a desire, as I evidently saw, of drawing me out. What could I do? He meant to please, and he tormented me. I felt as if he had placed carefully, one by one in my view, those instruments which were to be afterwards used in putting me into a slow and cruel death. I writhed under his words, yet dared not exhibit the pain I felt. Clerval, whose eyes and feelings were always quick in my discerning the sensations of others, declined the subject, alleging an excuse, his total ignorance, and the conversation took a more general turn. I thanked my friend from my heart, but I did not speak. I saw plainly that he was surprised, but he never attempted to draw my secret from me. And, although I loved him with a mixture of affection and reverence that knew no bounds, yet I could never persuade myself to confide in him that event which was so often present to my recollection, but which I feared the detail to another would only impress more deeply. Mr. Crimp was not equally docile, and in my condition at that time of almost insupportable sensitiveness, his harsh, blunt and comniums gave me even more pain than the benevolent approbation of M. Waldman. Darn the fellow. I think it's darn the fellow was what he's saying. It's either darn or the D word. He cried. Well, M. Clerville, I assure you, he has outstripped us all. I stare if you please, but it is nevertheless true. A youngster who, but a few years ago, believed in Cornelius Agrippa as firmly as in the gospel, has now set himself at the head of the university. And if he's not soon pulled down, we shall all be out of countenance. Aye, aye, continued he, observing my face expressive of suffering. M. Frankenstein is modest, an excellent quality in a young man. Young men should be diffident in themselves, you know. M. Clerville, I was myself when young, but that wears out in a very short time. M. Cramp had now commenced a eulogy on himself, which happily turned the conversation from the subject that was so annoying to me. Clerville had never sympathized in my taste for natural science, and his literary pursuits differed wholly from those which had occupied me. He came to the university with the design of making himself a complete master of the Oriental languages, and thus he should open a field for the plan of life he had marked out for himself. Resolved to pursue no inglorious career, he turned his eyes toward the East, as affording scope for his spirit of enterprise. The Persian, Arabic, and Sanskrit languages engaged his attention, and I was easily induced to enter in on the same studies. Idleness had ever been irksome to me, and now that I wished to fly from reflection and hated my former studies, I felt great relief in being the fellow pupil with my friend, and found not only instruction, but consolation in the works of the Orientalists. See, there's one that, Orientalists. I did not, like him, attempt a critical knowledge of their dialects, for I did not contemplate making any other use of them than temporary amusement. I read merely to understand their meaning, and they well repaid my labors. Their melancholy is soothing, and their joy elevating, to a degree I never experienced in studying the authors of any other country. When you read their writings, life appears to consist in a warm sun and garden of roses, in the smiles and frowns of a fair enemy, and the fire that consumes your own heart. How different from the manly and hero poetry of Greece and Rome. Summer passed away in these occupations, and my return to Geneva was fixed for the latter end of autumn. But being delayed by several accidents, winter and snow arrived. The roads were deemed impassable, and my journey was retarded until the ensuing spring. I felt this delay very bitterly, for I longed to see my native town and my beloved friends. My return had only been delayed so long, from an unwillingness to leave Clerval in a strange place, before he had become acquainted with any of its inhabitants. The winter, however, was spent cheerfully, and although the spring was uncommonly late when it came, its beauty compensated for its delay. The month of May had already commenced, and I expected the letter daily, which was to fix the date of my departure, when Henry proposed a pedestrian tour in the environs of Ingolstadt, that I might bid a personal farewell to the country I had so long inhabited. I acceded with pleasure to this proposal. I was fond of exercise, and Clerval had always been my favorite companion in the ramble of this nature that I had taken among the scenes of my native country. We passed a fortnight in these perambulations. My health and spirits had long been restored, and they gained additional strength from the air I breathed, the natural incidents of our progress, and the conversation of my friend. Study had before secluded me from the intercourse of my fellow creatures, and rendered me unsocial. But Clerval called forth the better feelings of my heart. He again taught me to love the aspect of nature and the cheerful faces of children. Excellent friend, how sincerely you did love me, and endeavor to elevate my mind until it was on a level with your own. A selfish pursuit had cramped and narrowed me until your gentleness and affection warmed and opened my senses. I became the same happy creature who, a few years ago, loved and beloved by all, had no sorrow or care. When happy, inanimate nature had the power of bestowing on me the most delightful sensations. A serene sky and verdant fields filled me with ecstasy. The present season was indeed divine. The flowers of spring bloomed in the hedges, while those of summer were already in bud. I was undisturbed by thoughts which, during the preceding year, had pressed upon me, notwithstanding my endeavors to throw them off with an invisible burden. Henry rejoiced at my gaiety and sincerely sympathized in my feelings. He exerted himself to amuse me, while he expressed the sensations that filled his soul. The resources of his mind on this occasion were truly astonishing. His conversation was full of imagination, and, very often, in imitation of the Persian and Arabic writers, he invented tales of wonderful fancy and passion. At other times, he repeated my favorite poems, or drew me out into arguments, which he supported with great ingenuity. We returned to our college on a Sunday afternoon. The peasants were dancing, and everyone we met appeared gay and happy. My own spirits were high, and I bounded along with feelings of unbridled joy and hilarity. Okay, guys, it is 7 o'clock. So I think this is what we're going to be doing on Sundays as far as timing goes, because it seems like I can get through 45 minutes of reading, you know, because I really would rather go from 6 to 6 or 6 to 7 and not go much beyond that, because when we read Dracula, we were hitting like hour and a half, 2 hour reads. I really don't want to do that. So we're going to stop at chapter 7 and continue next week, which would be next Sunday. So fantastic. Great book. Love it. I got a couple announcements before I go. Be on the lookout. I'm going to have a Halloween event coming up for California Haunted Paranormal Investigation Team. I'll have that announcement tomorrow. I've been planning it, and it's going to be over. The main thing is that it's going to be a virtual thing over on YouTube, but I think you guys will like it. I'm trying to start up a series on Saturday nights called Ghost Stories in the Dark. And so what I decided to do was I'm going to do a paid event for the first part of that series, and it's going to be over on YouTube. You guys will be in a private room. $15 per person. For those of you on the Patreon, that will be a free event for those of you members of the Patreon. But I'm going to go ahead and do that, and that will be a Halloween event. It's going to be Ghost Stories in the Dark, the 911 version. So we're going to get police officers and other law enforcement and nurses and, EMTs and people like that to feed me stories so I can tell you stories. So it's going to be kind of fun. It's going to be kind of fun. So I'm going to go ahead and get that arranged and set up and everything over on, over there, and let everybody know over at Meetup and all that good stuff. And then we're also going to be doing a walking ghost tour. It's either a walking tour or we're going to be doing a ghost hunt. And we're going to be taking people along on that as well. Live ghost hunt. Hopefully I'll be able to broadcast on TikTok for that ghost hunt. And we'll see how that goes. But trying to get all that arranged for Halloween as well. So there's a lot, there's quite a few things coming up. There is a newsletter coming out. I'm just about finished with the newsletter. So that'll be coming out as well for people to see the newsletter. Tomorrow night, I'll be back. And I will be telling ghost stories. I will be talking about haunted Washington, D.C. And that'll be something that I'm going to do. That TikTok will be involved with as well. So I'll be live on TikTok. Whoop, hang on. Got to fix the thing. Got to do a stupid thing here. Hang on. Okay. I hate the puzzle. Anyway, that'll be live on TikTok tomorrow, as well as Facebook, YouTube, and Twitch. So I'm going to, at 6:30 p.m. Pacific, I will be back to tell ghost stories about Washington, D.C. All right, so that'll be tomorrow's show. But anyway, thank you everybody for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it. Like I said, there's a bunch of changes coming to what we're going to be doing here. Also, tomorrow night, 10 p.m. Pacific, after I get off the air from doing my regular show, I also have something special going on TikTok. Okay, I'll make the announcement tomorrow night to let everybody know what that is. I'll make an early announcement about it. But I will be doing something at 10 p.m. Pacific just for TikTok. So, yeah, stick with me. We're going to be doing a lot more. You know, we're going to be a lot more over here on this side as far as the main radio show goes. And then we're going to be doing other stuff over on TikTok now. Especially now that I figured out how to prop you guys up so you don't fall. Last week you guys fell. Week before that you guys fell. So I'm glad I figured this out for TikTok. All right, guys, I will see you all tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Pacific. and we're going to talk about the ghosts of Washington, D.C. I want everybody to have a great evening and the rest of your weekend. TikTok, hang out with me for a while because we're going to do the finishing touches on the show. So let's go ahead and see you guys.